Hello and welcome to Bath for our live podcast at the Bath Festival, and we even have a live, well I think they're alive, a live audience with us, Jackie. Now this is actually the first time we've been in the same room recording the podcast together, isn't it?
It is, because usually I'm sitting in my front room, you're sitting in your house. You are very honoured, actually, audience today, because we are fully dressed. On occasions, we have been in our pyjamas, or Ian tells me, even worse. And that's not a picture you're going to get out of your head very easily during the course.
Have you been to Bath before?
I've been once before, but I think I will come again, because we had a lovely evening yesterday.
We did. We went to the Crystal Palace restaurant, which if ever, any of you are from Bath, do go to. It's one of the best meals I've had this year. Now, lots of famous people are from Bath, Jackie. Anne Widdecombe is from Bath, and I used to do a theatre tour, A Night with Anne Widdecombe, and we used to do sort of 100 theatres around the country. In fact, we came to Bath, and it was just a sort of in conversation, and I remember the first time I ever appeared on Any Questions, I was very, very nervous, and Jonathan Dimbleby announced that I used to do this theatre tour, and he just looked at me and he said, "So Ian, is it a whole night?" And I just said, "A gentleman never tells."
As we were sitting in the green room just waiting for this before, Ian said to me, "Oh, I haven't felt like this since I was with Anne Widdecombe." So what it is about me that reminds him of Anne Widdecombe, I am unclear, but anyway.
Well, let me tell everyone what we're going to talk about in the podcast today. I think we have to start with the royal wedding, don't we? We'll look at some of the issues that that threw up yesterday. We'll talk about the new peerages that were announced on Friday. A good day to bury bad news, maybe. John Bercow, has he got a future of speaker of the House of Commons? And we might touch on a bit about Brexit and Carillion, and we'll take your questions from our live audience here in Bath. They've even got nice little forms to fill in. Jackie's actually created these herself. You'd never guess that she used to be a teacher. Would you? Well, all that coming up in the next 50 minutes. So, the royal wedding. Now, I'm not sure whether you're particularly a royalist or not. I can imagine a lot of you and your ilk sitting, watching television, slightly tutting.
No, I'm not a particular royalist. If I was designing our constitution today, I would not start with an unelected so-called aristocratic royal family at the top of it as the sort of head of state. However, having said all of that, I am a romantic. I thought that the wedding was lovely. I thought it said some really positive things about our country and how the monarchy has developed, and the fact that we could have a, as she describes herself, biracial woman marrying into the royal family.
I never heard of that word until this week. But we always use the term mixed race, don't we?
Yeah. I think she, apparently she came up with that description for herself, and I quite liked it. And I thought the way in that which that was reflected in the ceremony, with the gospel choir, with the fabulous Bishop Michael Curry's address.
We'll come on to that in a bit.
we did.
I have other words for it, which don't include fabulous.
with the cellist, all of that, I thought, said something about modern Britain, which you don't often see reflected in the royal family.
I think all that's true, and I think there were parts of it that were actually quite emotional. I will cry at Emmerdale, so maybe I'm not a very good example of lacrimosity. No, I'm a good example.
You are a good example of it, yeah.
But you shed a few tears, you told me last night, didn't you?
Listen, I'm the mum of two boys.
It's hard-bitten politician, shedding tears.
I have a soft side. And when William and Harry got out of the car and walked down the path, I'm feeling a bit emotional now, walked down the path to the chapel, I think lots of people said that was the point when they thought their mum isn't there to see this today, and we're reminded of Harry walking behind the coffin at Diana's funeral. So at that point, I felt a bit teary. I felt a bit teary at the idea that he actually looked as if he really loved her when she walked up the aisle.
Which is always nice on a wedding day.
Which is nice, but not necessarily a given with royal.
Did you feel like that on your wedding day?
Well,
bearing in mind Richard's in the audience.
He is, yeah, yeah. I felt weepy, yeah. We got married in a civil ceremony before the days when you could have a civil ceremony in nice surroundings. So we got married in the planning office of the Malvern registry office. It wasn't that big a room, but we had quite a big wedding, and we tried to trim down the people who actually came to the service. But you can imagine aunts, uncles, etc., they weren't having it. So they piled into this room. There was standing room only in this planning office. And the registrar, who was a woman, which was nice, came in and said, ooh, gulp, what a lovely lot of people there are here. But I, for example, at our wedding, made the speech. Richard didn't make the speech.
Start as you mean to go on.
And I thought there were elements of we had a bit of a Twitter spat, didn't we, about whether or not there was symbolism in Meghan walking herself down the aisle or being walked down the aisle by Prince Charles. And there was some discussion about whether or not it would have been a better symbol for her mother to walk her down the aisle. But actually, I was satisfied by the fact that she walked herself partway down the aisle.
Well, we had a bit of a spat because a friend of ours, Sarah Hayward, who used to be the Labour leader, is at Camden Council?
Yeah.
She tweeted this: can there be a more potent symbol of the continued existence of patriarchal power structures than a white royal man treating his new daughter-in-law as a possession and usurping a black woman in the process? And I just thought, dear, oh dear, oh dear. I mean, on the day before the wedding, I mean, even if you think that, what's the point in even saying it?
Well, because when would you say it? That was the day when the symbolism was clear.
But the point was, and Kensington Palace made this clear, that she asked Prince Charles to do it.
Yeah.
So on what basis does Sarah or you have to question that?
I'm not saying she didn't make the decision to do it, but the symbolism remains. Even when people make a decision to go along with the symbolism, that symbolism of patriarchy and possession and all of the things that go alongside that type of a marriage ceremony remain even when you choose to buy into it.
But Prince Charles was not giving her away, was he? Which, well, I mean, that I do agree with you. It is a sign of sort of a man owning a woman and then giving the woman over to somebody else. I completely get that. But of course, the tradition element here has to come in, doesn't it? Because a lot of, even in 21st century Britain, I think most women who get married, if their fathers are still around, actually really want that to happen. They don't really think about the patriarchal side of it. Why should they?
Because it's part of their oppression.
Oh, God.
Like
the
that
lady
is
nodding there. but normal people outside politics.
What do you mean normal people?
Well, I'm sorry.
Some normal people, Ian.
No, they're not. Normal people outside politics and outside the media bubble do not think in this way.
It's completely possible to have watched that wedding yesterday and to have said, what a beautiful spectacle, how lovely that they seem to love each other, and also to be able to have a political analysis of it. And it's not somehow or another being sort of churlish or unpatriotic to apply your political values to it at the same time as you're saying, oh, that's really quite lovely.
I agree with you on watching Harry and William walking sort of down the, I don't know what it is, the bit outside the castle beforehand. I thought that was moving. And like you, I thought of Diana then. Did you know I have a link to Diana? I used to own her car.
she tenuous. Well, did she sell it you?
Well, she sold it to me via Dovercourt, the dealer. But the thing is, I actually have a picture of her in it with Harry and William clambering over the back seat. And when I wanted to buy an Audi Cabriolet, and I was going to buy a new one, but Audi then couldn't deliver it when I wanted it, so I went around dealers in London trying to find one. There was this beautiful sort of turquoise one with white leather seats. It had only done 4,000 miles. And I just said to the dealer, I said, well, what's the story behind that? Why would anyone get rid of that after 4,000 miles? And he said, oh, it's Princess Diana. So I thought, yeah, right. And anyway, it was, because he had all
one careful lady owner.
He had all the Daily Mail articles of her pictured in it. So I thought, oh, I've got to have that. But I only kept it a year, and I sold it a year before she died. And if I had kept it, it was then sold in auction, I'm told, to someone in Malaysia for £1 million. However, it is on auction again this week, believe it or not, for a cut-down price of £62,000.
Oh, right.
So decreased in value. But yeah, that's my connection.
Right.
Did you ever meet her?
No, I never did, actually. I have met, as you can imagine, quite a few members of the royal family because I'm a privy councillor. So I
get her.
I used to attend. The Privy Council, of course, is the group of most senior ministers and some other people who are appointed in the in former days to provide counsel to the monarchy, but now really largely ceremonial, except of course for the fact that there is this idea of there being sort of privy council rules for the disclosure of confidential information. So quite often shadow Home Secretaries or shadow Foreign Secretaries will also be made Privy Councillors in order that you can talk to them about security issues on the basis that that will remain confidential. But of course, the other duty of the Privy Council is it meets periodically for the Queen to formally approve various regulations. It's a pretty formal type of meeting. It's done completely standing up. You sort of have a rota of senior ministers who volunteer to go. You always try and get yourself onto the Christmas one, because at the Christmas one, at the end of the formal meeting, servant comes out with a tray full of drinks. I got a gin and tonic, quite a strong one, if I remember rightly, for sort of day-to-day politicians. It's a rather weird meeting because essentially the president of the council, who's a senior cabinet minister, will sort of announce the business and the Queen will say approved, and then you'll go into the next one, the Queen will say approved. There ain't no arguing or proposing of amendments or any of that stuff.
So what you're saying is a complete and utter waste of time.
I have written over the Privy Council that I can see no reason whatsoever for its continued existence, because it's perfectly possible to do that security confidentiality thing through other routes. So there is no reason for its existence. But you have to have, if you have a royal family and a head of state in that state, you have to have all of that paraphernalia around, which is what, you know, if I were designing the system from scratch, I would get rid of.
But as Home Secretary, how much interaction do you have with, but did you know that Jackie was Home Secretary once, by the way?
As Home Secretary, do you know who I was?
Yeah. How much interaction do you have with the Queen?
You don't have direct interaction. You have interaction by way of the Privy Council. I probably had more interaction with Prince Charles because he did quite a few of the organisations that I was involved in. So I sat next to him at the Police Bravery Awards, for example. And of course, as Home Secretary, you get invited to state banquets. So I went to the state banquet for the Saudi royal family, the time before last when they came to the UK, with enormous numbers of hangers-on. And I am proud to say that in the state banquet where I was sat next to the Minister for Information, the Saudi Minister for Information, I did manage to get to the point of saying to him, is it really not possible for you in Saudi to allow women to drive? And he said...
He chopped your hand off.
He sort of smiled slightly forbearingly as if to say, oh God, another one of these Western politicians, blah, blah, and said, well, of course, it will take us time to get round to that situation. It's taken too bloody long, but they are, this week, of course, bringing in the regulation in Saudi that will enable women to drive. They've arrested several outspoken supporters of that in the run-up to it, so I'm not seeing this as a sort of major freeing up of the political or social environment in Saudi, but it is an important step forward.
How do we get onto Saudi from the Queen? This is how this podcast works.
And we haven't
it's like a Ronnie Corbett monologue. It sort of veers off in all sorts of different directions. So what's the longest conversation you had with the Queen?
It would have been after a Privy Council, when she is actually surprisingly dry and funny. And, I mean, you know, she has seen off numerous politicians during her time, but she's actually quite warm and amusing about the way she talks.
The only time I've ever met her was at a reception at Buckingham Palace for the book industry, and I remember going with my partner, who is the most unpushy person you could ever come across, and there are about 800 people there, and I thought, we're never ever going to get to meet the Queen. So he said to me, well, if we stand here, she's got to come out this way, so she'll have to walk past us. So we plonked ourselves in this position, and sure enough, she did. And we talked to her for about 5 minutes, which, bearing in mind there were 800 people there, was quite a lot, and she was very funny. Mm. And I was thinking, everyone thinks it's sort of, hey, what do you do? And that's about the extent of her conversation. It wasn't like that at all. She's absolutely tiny, though, isn't she? And it was hilarious to watch all these people trying to muscle their way into the conversation. And as they did, we'd just gently change our position a little bit. And of course, once we'd finished the conversation with her, we left because we'd done what we set out to achieve.
Can you see yourself getting her on to do an LBC phone-in, Ian?
Can you imagine that? I think Prince Philip would be great on an LBC phone-in.
I want to know what Prince Philip said when they got back into the car about Michael Curry's sermon.
It's best not to speculate, because if we did, this might be the last ever For the Many podcast. I think, what was it the Queen has said to have said that sort of, you should say what you've got to say, say it again, and then be seated.
That's
or
what
something.
He did.
Yeah, but 13 minutes. She reckons the sermon should last no longer than 7 minutes, and I'm with her on that.
But you see, I am naturally, if I have any sort of religious allegiance, it's a sort of reasonably straightforward...
To Tony Blair.
Yeah, well, obviously, but it's a reasonably straightforward Anglican background where I'm used to going to church and it all being rather staid. But actually, the insertion into that service of an American, much more charismatic preacher from the Episcopal Church in the US, I thought was a masterstroke. And the fact that he introduced that passion, that he preached in the way, incidentally, that quite a few British black Christians would have felt comfortable with, said something really important about that service. I mean, you know, the man was not short of passion in his preaching.
No, but the problem was that a lot of it was totally irrelevant to the day.
No, it wasn't. He was talking about love.
And then he talked about fire. What has fire got to do with the price of fish?
But his point was that, and I was still listening at this point, if you could discover... No, I slightly forgotten what his point was now. If you could discover the way in which...
I rest my case, ladies and gentlemen.
If you could essentially discover the new fire through love, you would have a power that changed the world. And the fact that he was able to use the expression, make poverty history, and to quote Martin Luther King in St. George's Chapel, Windsor, was a big positive statement for me.
Well, it was 13 minutes, and it was a performance, and he clearly went totally off script. You could see halfway through, he just launched into it. I mean, it was entertaining, I'll give you that. But I did, I mean, you could, the pictures on the faces of various royals was absolutely hilarious. And so in a way, it was enjoyable, and people will remember it for that, I'm sure. What about the media coverage of the whole thing? Because I kept getting people tweeting me saying, oh, can you please not talk about the royal wedding on your programme? Enough already. But then, of course, you've got, and I think it did split the nation. You had half the nation thinking, don't talk about it at all, and then the other half couldn't get enough of it. And I think for all, whether it's TV, radio, whatever, it's a very difficult decision as to what balance to strike.
I thought on balance there was probably slightly more than was necessary yesterday. And certainly, when I look at all of the newspaper, I suppose the newspapers are always a day behind, so it's obvious that on their front pages they're going to be having pictures today. But the fact that then at the beginning of March there was quite a lot of talk about the royal wedding, that all of the news programmes are still following it, that's too much. Let's get back to, you know, in one way it was a nice break from the sort of dirge and challenges that we're facing in the political world at the moment, internationally and in the UK. But I'm afraid we need to put the fairy tale prince and princess behind us and get back to the challenges of Brexit, of Carillion, of all of the other political...
Getting rid of anti-Semitism in the Labour Party.
Indeed. all of the other challenges that we face.
I did flick through the different channels yesterday watching it, and I thought the BBC coverage was just boring. You compare it to, I should declare an interest in that, I present a co-presenter program on CNN, but I thought their coverage was absolutely great. You had the sort of split screens, there was energy behind it, and they didn't just cater it for an American audience, it was a real international event. And Sky and ITV, I thought, really captured the moment better. Who wants to see Dermot O'Leary on a couch on Royal Wedding Day?
I thought he was good, I thought he was fine.
Okay, if you say so.
I mean, obviously, I'd rather have seen you on a couch.
I think we'd have done a brilliant job. We're trying to be the new Richard and Judy, aren't we?
He shows his age when he talks about Richard and Judy.
Well, Richard's still around. Well, let's move on. Let's talk a little bit about some of the political news of the week. Let's turn to the Speaker of the House of Commons, John Bercow, who I was at university with, and I remember as being an extreme right-winger in those days, fully in favour of voluntary repatriation for immigrants. He was secretary of the Immigration Committee of the Monday Club, I seem to remember. And he's undergone a complete political transformation since then. Now, in many ways, he's been a good speaker. He's been a reforming speaker. But do you not think he should now go? He said he would stay for 9 years. That 9 years is up on the 22nd of June. He's mired in controversy over bullying. And now, this week, he's, and he hasn't denied it, he apparently called Andrea Leadsom, the leader of the House of Commons, an effing stupid woman. If he'd said that about a Labour politician, I think he'd be toast already.
I mean, first of all, you're right about his journey. My first Prime Minister's question was about John Bercow. It was before he was the Speaker.
When were you Prime Minister then?
No, I asked it before.
Oh, right.
First,
well, I missed that.
When I was a backbencher, right back at immediately after 1997, I asked a question about whether or not the member for wherever he is, Buckingham, would apologise for having been one of those students that wore a Hang Nelson Mandela badge, because he notoriously did as a member of the Federation of Conservative Students. But to give him his due, he has made an enormous political journey. And I do think that his time as Speaker in the House of Commons, and I voted for him to be the Speaker when he was chosen, has been a real reforming time. You've seen a big shift. And this is one of the reasons why ministers, Tories in particular, don't like him, because he has really worked to try to bring back influence to the House of Commons. So he will demand that ministers come to the chamber and ask questions. He will demand that Parliament is given time. The reason, of course, he was wholly wrong to say that about Andrea Leadsom, but the reason he was angry was because the government was trying to sneak in a government statement on an opposition day when the opposition was trying to run a debate on information about Brexit and, in fact, about Grenfell. And he quite rightly said it is not the done thing for the government to take up the time of the opposition on the few days in the year that they have. So I don't condone his behaviour, although, you know, quite a lot of it has been denied by him and people
around him.
That, to be fair, that hasn't. But and I think, actually, he may be coming to the end of his time anyway, because he said, in 2009, when he was re-elected, that he was only going to serve another 9 years. And perhaps he will decide that this is an appropriate time to go. But I hope he isn't. I really hope he isn't forced out, because that would say something bad about what happens to speakers that try to reform the House of Commons.
Well, because the last speaker was forced out, wasn't he?
Michael Martin,
who died a couple of weeks ago. Can I just make clear that I never wore a Hang Nelson Mandela badge when I was in the Federation of Conservative Students?
Well, we're all pleased to hear that.
Sally Burko is an interesting character, isn't she? And John Burko's wife. I used to do, before you came on the scene, I used to do paper reviews with her on Sky News. And I remember going back into central London in a cab one evening after a paper review, and she told me that she'd been pictured in the Marriott Hotel opposite the House of Commons, looking over to Big Ben, just draped in a bedsheet. And I did think to myself, aren't you going to regret that? And I said, have you told John? And she said, no, do you think I should? And of course, the next day it appeared in the Evening Standard, and it was an absolutely massive scandal. I think he's been very embarrassed by some of her antics, and their marriage went through a very dodgy phase. But she's keen that they should leave, because she doesn't like living, because it must be very odd living basically on the Big Ben.
And she's got young children, and they're forced to live in an apartment. I mean, as we know, the whole of the Palace of Westminster is having, you know, MPs and peers are going to have to move out in order that it can be refurbished. And that's not some sort of MPs voting to spend large amounts of money on making their surroundings luxurious. I mean, honestly, when I was Home Secretary, I had an office that backed onto the chamber of the House of Commons. There were permanent mouse traps in there because of the other sorts of vermin that ran around the House of Commons. There was a constant moth problem. You wouldn't want to leave any clothes in there.
That's Gordon Brown's wallet.
Yes, prudence. Prudence with a purpose. And so, you know, I would think it is not, in one way you think, how fantastic to live under Big Ben, but actually it is no fun living there. And she, of course, has been really for the reasons that you say, has previously been in a media spotlight that's been, I think, very unpleasant for her and John.
I mentioned Gordon Brown there. Let's deviate from what we were going to do, because I think Gordon Brown, we almost forget him now. It's 8 years ago that he left Downing Street. But he was a titanic figure in British politics for 20 years. He made you Home Secretary. What was your relationship with him like?
Well, I suppose I had all of the time. The thing you can say about Gordon is that I think he was the greatest Chancellor of the Exchequer this country has ever had. He did lead the response to the financial crisis in 2008, led the world in the response to the financial crisis. He is a brilliant politician. He was very good in building a team around him. I was never part of, you know, I would never have been seen as a Brownite in the run-up to the change of Prime Minister.
So why did he appoint you? This is what we all want to know.
Thank you. I think, one, rightly, he wanted to have a woman in a senior position. Two, as I understand it, several people around him, including Alistair Darling, said that I was a good performer in that, in the House of Commons. I didn't just emerge from nowhere to become Home Secretary. No, I had been a minister in five other roles from 1999 to 2007, including as Chief Whip, so I had a good understanding of the sort of politics of the Parliamentary Labour Party and across government. I'd been in education, I'd been in health, I'd been in industry, I'd been a quality minister. So, and I, you know, without blowing my own trumpet, I had a good reputation as a minister. So I think those were all the reasons why he
did you ever experience the telephone throwing moments?
No, honestly, genuinely, I never did. I mean, I found Gordon quite, you know, genuinely respectful to me. I mean, to be fair, he didn't, with a few exceptions, because of the financial crisis, he didn't devote an enormous amount of time to what was going on in the Home Office. Unlike perhaps Tony Blair before him, for whom crime, tackling crime, was obviously a big focus, and he did sort of turn his attention to what was happening in the Home Office. But I used to try, because, you know, the problem with Gordon is that he is intensely serious, and he's probably overly serious. And I used to be the minister that would go into Number 10 and say, when are you going on your holidays? And there'd be a sort of, oh, Dracu, because he wasn't a man who naturally thought about his holidays. But he probably, he was so focused on what he had to do. But I suppose he, in one way his problem was that whilst he'd been a brilliant Chancellor, he hadn't wholly thought through what he wanted to do as Prime Minister. And to the extent that he had, it was thrown off by the financial crisis.
Are you going to tell us that anecdote you told us over dinner last night?
Which one was that?
About the PMQs. Where?
Oh, yes. Yeah. So Ian was asking me, we were talking about a new book that Ian has published by Aisha Hazarika and Tom Hamilton about Prime Minister's Questions and preparing the Prime Minister for Prime Minister's Questions. And the only, the input I had into preparing for Prime Minister's Questions was the making sure that the Home Office was doing the briefing necessary that has to go to Number 10 before each week's Prime Minister's Questions. And there was one occasion, and I was sitting, if not next to him, then certainly close to him on the front bench, when he got a hard time and slightly, I think, didn't give as good an answer as he could have done on an issue that was a Home Office responsibility. And after we returned to the Home Office after that, I mean, first of all, he was reasonably grumpy at the time. And when we returned to the Home Office, we were on the receiving end, both me and officials, of a phone call that was, to say the least, the gruff Gordon Brown, as opposed to the charming Gordon Brown, about what he felt about the quality of the briefing that he'd received. I won't try and do
No, go on. She did a brilliant impression of Gordon Brown last night. Over the, go on.
Gordon, hello, Jackie. This briefing. We've got to get it straight. We've got to get it clear. We've got to get the message out there.
That wasn't as good as last night.
Sorry.
Do you still talk to him?
I haven't spoken to him for quite a long time, actually. But
he does seem to have cut himself off, doesn't he?
Well, he's doing a lot of important... He's just, in the last week, I think, launched a global education fund, which is the thing that he is really doing now and is passionate about, along with Sarah, his wife. He does a lot of that international work. And let's not forget, you know, he was the Chancellor that massively increased investment in international development and reduced the and removed the debt for a lot of developing countries. So this is something that he's had an ongoing interest in that he's pursuing now outside Parliament.
Do you know, that's one of the issues that a lot of people who phone into my radio show cannot understand, why, when we can't afford to spend X, Y, and Z on X, Y, and Z, we are spending £13 billion a year in the international aid budget. And I actually think that this country should be proud that, I think in Andrew Mitchell's words, we are now an international aid superpower. We are second only to the United States in the world on that. And I think there are many benefits from that. But it's very difficult to explain to someone who can't get a council house, or finds that their work in the public sector and their wage rises are restricted to 1%. How do you persuade people like that actually international aid at this level is a good thing?
Well, one, because I think it's perfectly possible to pay people in the public sector reasonably, and to build enough houses, and to invest in your position as a world leader and your responsibility to alleviate poverty wherever it happens in the world. And that if you make a decision to pursue austerity, that's the reason why you can't do it, not because you're living up to your responsibilities to the world. I mean, secondly, I think fair dues to David Cameron, who was willing to make that argument within the Conservative Party and maintain the 0.7% of GDP that we spend on international aid. But it's, I mean, I think you've made the argument yourself, Ian. We have, I mean, we're diminishing it through what we're doing with Brexit at the moment, but we have always had an important role in the world that perhaps is larger than our physical size and population would suggest. And we've done that, yes, sometimes through military power, but we've also done it by being willing to engage in the issues around of development around the world. And I do a lot of work in Jordan and in the Middle East. And one, it is right anyway to invest in a country that is a sort of oasis of stability in a really dangerous and unstable region. But secondly, the idea that it wouldn't have an impact on us if the Middle East became even more unstable than it is at the moment is bizarre, you know. So although there is an altruistic reason and there is a self-interested reason why we should invest in stability across the world.
Let's do another Ronnie Corbett monologue diversion onto the Middle East. The events this week in Gaza and Palestine have been worrying, to say the least. And I speak as somebody who is a strong supporter of Israel, but sometimes even when you're a strong supporter of Israel, you have to call them to account for things that they do, which you just think, well, there must have been other ways of combating the violent protests. And yes, of course they were set up by Hamas. But the idea seems to be that, I mean, the initial defense of the IDF was, they're trying to get through the fence and therefore they'll try and kill Israelis. So, and we haven't had a shoot to kill policy, even though we've killed 60 people. Well, the next day it emerged that 50 of these 60 people were members of Hamas. And they said, see, told you so. And I'm thinking, well, the logic of that argument means that if you are a member of Hamas, you deserve to be shot.
I completely agree with you. And it's wholly possible to both condemn the influence of Hamas in organising that protest, whilst recognising that, you know, I mean, for goodness sake, in very many countries in the world, it's possible to have protests and even reasonably violent protests without state apparatus turning on those protesters and killing larger numbers of people. And it is just wholly wrong. And it's something, incidentally, that should be subject. I mean, firstly, I think rightly, people have condemned it immediately. And it should be something that's subject to a UN inquiry, which appears to be being blocked at the moment. But it links to something that we were talking about last week or the week before, about whether or not, you know, there is not one view in Israel about the way to pursue peace, right? Let's not think that there is only one way. But what is clear is the sort of hardline Netanyahu view has probably been strengthened by the decision to shift the embassy to Jerusalem, by the withdrawal of Trump from the Iran deal. That means that it's harder for moderates and those who want to pursue peace in Israel to prevail.
And we're going to come on to questions in a moment. But before we do, so if you have any questions, do send the sheets up here for us. You wanted to have a quick word about Carillion. Which
I did. And Ian mentioned earlier on that I chair an NHS hospital trust in Birmingham and Solihull, which runs four hospitals. And the other hospital in Birmingham is a big new £350 million hospital development that is really necessary and is being built, or rather it was being built, because if you drive past the site now, it is a two-thirds finished building with a wholly deserted site, nobody on there at all. And the reason for that is because it was a Carillion contract. And I thought that the Work and Pensions Committee, and particularly the Business Select Committee, with Rachel Reeves as its chair, did a very good job this week in holding the directors to account, identifying the truly shocking way in which they had managed the business. Frankly, the almost negligent way in which the auditors had failed to identify the fact that the business was in trouble, and the reality of what that means, which is 20,000 people employed in the UK by Carillion who have now lost their jobs, and enormous numbers of buildings like the one that I drive past, and other services that are now not able to be delivered. And John McDonnell made, I thought, a good intervention yesterday.
Jackie Smith praises John McDonnell.
I don't always say that, but he made a good intervention yesterday in which he talked about the need for there to be a much better and clearer and stronger regulatory approach to our corporate and particularly our sort of auditing world. And I suppose I should make a confession that when I was industry minister, I had responsibility for the sort of audit area. And I looked at the time at the fact that it is largely controlled by four big accounting companies, and I felt that that was wrong. And we didn't take action when we could have done. And that is a regret of mine, to open it up to smaller auditors, to make it, ironically, I believe where you have a competitive business, it should be competitive. Mm. And the trouble, of course, with the audit setup is you've effectively got an oligopoly of four providers. So it isn't proper competition. So that I actually wanted to open up.
But this is happening in so many areas of our society where you have big companies swallowing up small ones. So sort of eventually you get three or four big companies and all the others have gone. And it's not just in the auditing sector. I mean, we could go through virtually every aspect of the economy. And I think that's a real challenge for government, because those of us who think that capitalism is still the best form, well, nobody's actually invented a system better as far as I can see, it's quite difficult to defend capitalism. I find it, as somebody who was a big proponent of privatisation back in the 80s and 90s, when you look at the way some of these industries were privatised, it's quite clear that it was done in the wrong way, and what we've ended up with is virtual monopolies. And you can't, if you haven't got competition, don't be surprised if people then rip the customer off.
And we recently had, I've recently been involved with a big merger of two hospital trusts in Birmingham. Because we were both foundation trusts, we had to get the approval of the Competition and Markets Authority to bring two trusts together with a clear benefit for patients. So we had to go through a lengthy, expensive process with the Competition and Markets Authority in the provision of healthcare, and yet they don't seem to be able to tackle some of those real private sector areas where there is not enough competition.
I mean, we have challenger banks now, but how many of us have changed our bank accounts from one of the big four to the challenger banks? You have supposed competition in the energy sector now, where people are, I think, how many of you have switched away from the big six? About a third of you. And I mean, I only did it about a couple of years ago, and I went to Octopus Energy, who I think are absolutely fantastic. Really good customer service, cheaper prices, and they actually make you feel like a valued customer. And
I'm not that being, wasn't an advert.
I'm not being paid to say that. I should. Whenever you see, this is the thing. Whenever you say something nice about a company, you get emails from people. Whenever I do it on the radio, I get emails from people saying, "Yeah, I bet they bunged you X, Y, and Z." I bought a pair of shoes. In fact, I bought quite a few pairs of shoes from a company called Coogan London.
Oh, he's doing
and
it again.
And I tweeted that they were brilliant. £42 a pair, really good value for money, really comfortable. And of course, then people say, "Oh, I bet they gave you free shoes." And then, funnily enough, I did get an email from them saying, "Thank you for your tweet. Would you like a pair of free shoes?" And I said, "Absolutely not," because I think once you get into that, it's a very slippery slope. Now, we've got some very challenging questions
we have
to
indeed.
Answer here. Dialogue of the deaf, it's headed. Is that a comment on us, do you think? Trump's base holds up despite everything. Whichever side of Brexit you're on denies facts. Question, how can you persuade people to listen to alternative views and facts? Mm-hmm. Shall I start on that one?
Yeah, go on.
One of the frustrations I find, for those of you who don't know, I host a radio show, Drive Time on LBC Radio, every day, weekdays. And over the past few months, obviously, we've talked about Russia quite a lot because of Syria and obviously the Skripal case in Salisbury. And I cannot believe how many people are absolutely convinced of the Russian side of the argument. They take all of their information from Russia Today or what I would regard as lunatic conspiracy theorist websites. And I don't know whether people are paid to phone up radio shows to put that side of you, but I came to the conclusion that some of them must, because the volume was just so overwhelming. And that is partly because I think people have lost trust in what they call the mainstream media, whether it's newspapers, even the BBC. People think the BBC have an agenda. They can never quite define what it is. Mm. They think that I have an agenda or my strings are being pulled by my masters. Now, in 8 years, I have never been asked or told to cover a subject by the management of my radio company. I've never been told not to say anything. And yet there is this general view out there that people like me are puppets of somebody. Mm. How has that come about?
But that's become about because there is also a view, isn't there, that the elite, including mainstream politicians, of which I was formerly one, are also not listening to what people have to say. And that's why you have this growth of populism, not just in the UK, across the world, of course, and the question references Trump. I mean, to be fair, you also have mainstream politicians like Michael Gove saying, oh, we're past the era of experts. Well, actually, we shouldn't be. There are people who have knowledge to which we should listen. Not all views are equally valid. There are some things that are
objectively right. But who's to judge which views are equally valid?
Because there are some things that are objectively right and some things that are objectively wrong.
But every decision that we make is a subjective. I mean, the fact that I have 3 hours in my show and I devote 1 hour to one subject, 1 hour to another, and 1 hour to another, that is a subjective decision on my part.
There are certain things which are the subject of your particular values and opinions. And one of the other problems, and it's reflected incidentally in another question in there, is that I think we've slightly got to a position in politics where you can't respect the fact that people may come from different positions and take different...
Well, let's take that question. It's from Caroline. She says, I listen to your podcast while walking the dog. I dread to think what other people are doing while they listen to our podcast. Anyway.
Swearing at the radio.
So I'm sorry I came up to you at the beginning and greeted you like long-lost friends, but that's
lovely.
The nature of a podcast. What I like is it's possible to agree and disagree while remaining calm and pleasant. Why has politics become so unpleasant?
Mm. I think one of the things that Ian and I try and do in the podcast, although we come from wholly different political backgrounds, firstly, we actually quite like each other and we respect the position, well, actually, we understand the position that each of us is coming from. What we find is quite often there are lots of things on which we agree. Both of us, I think, have sort of changed our views as a result of our conversation. But we also believe that politics and political debate is a virtuous and honourable thing to do and an important thing to do. And one of the problems, I think, is that that has been downgraded and people take positions and they question. I think the problem is if you question the motives of somebody who disagrees with you, that's when political debate becomes almost impossible. So I don't like that sort of discussion. And incidentally, that's what drives some of that alienation from politics, because you begin to get people saying, well, why should I listen to what that person says? They're only in it for themselves, or they're being paid by their masters to do it, or whatever. You've got to believe that people come into politics and political decision-making with good motives, even if you disagree with them.
I think part of the answer is that social media has absolutely ruined our political discourse. If you're on Twitter or other forms of social media, you will see it every day. I mean, that tweet that I read out earlier from Sarah Hayward about the royal wedding, I responded to that and I said, I think it's a really bad thing to say. My tweet was perfectly respectful. But what I found is that, I mean, I have about 110,000 Twitter followers. I've no idea who all of them are, obviously. But I've seen this happen before, where I have taken on somebody and then I have these people refer them to as my little army of followers, who will then descend on that person. And if it's just like an ordinary member of the public, that can be quite an unpleasant experience. Mm. And I don't feel that I've provoked that, but clearly it does happen. Owen Jones, who, I mean, is big enough to speak up for himself, but he says this happens to him a lot. If ever I tweet something or I disagree with him, he then gets dogs abuse from people. Mm. And it can be, I mean, I've had it many times myself, and it's a profoundly uncomfortable thing for 2 or 3 days of your life. Unless you just switch off Twitter, your life is made absolute hell. But I think it goes deeper than that. We have the electorate, I think, is actually partly to blame for this, because the electorate demands perfection from politicians, and most politicians are just as flawed as everybody else. And the electorate either says, why can't you all get along? Or they say, well, there's no point in voting because you're all the same. Although, if you think about it, those two things are completely incompatible. And now we have a system where Jeremy Corbyn calls for kinder, gentler politics, where very rarely does he condemn any of the things that his supporters do, whether it's on social media or not. And you have two political parties who are further away from each other than they have been since the Thatcher era. Under Tony Blair, people I think, probably had a case of saying, well, you're all a bit the same. But if you go through virtually any policy area now, there are clear differences. Now, in theory, that ought to be a good thing because the electorate then has a choice.
Yeah, and that's not the problem. The problem is not that there are clear differences of position. The problem is that people can't respect the right of others to hold a different position. And incidentally, I mean, I have to say, and I suspect this is the same in the Tory party as well, there is as much, if not more, vitriol between members of the same party as there is across the party divide. You know, of course there is, you know, people like, and we've talked about Laura Pidcock, MP, who I think rather unfortunately said she could never imagine being friends with a Tory. And that, in some ways, that's unfortunate, although I can understand when you're an MP, actually, you are quite tribal and quite a lot of your time is spent thinking about how you pursue your own political position. But the fact that it's that people are equating the decency of a person with their political views is part of the reason why we've got into this unhealthy political debate, which other people then either join in with and question your motives, or it alienates them completely from politics, and they say, that's it, I don't want to have anything to do.
Let's take another one. This question comes up virtually every week in one form or another, but I love asking it to Jackie. Do you think Jeremy Corbyn will ever become Prime Minister? If not, why not? And is it a good idea? And the other one that people normally ask is, Jackie, how can you still be in the Labour Party with what Jeremy Corbyn's doing?
I'm still in the Labour Party because I've been in the Labour Party for 40 years, and I can't imagine a better vehicle to deliver the values and the change that I want to see in the country. And in fact, for 13 years, it did precisely that during my lifetime. I mean, if there were a general election tomorrow, I would vote for Jeremy Corbyn to be the Prime Minister. I don't think, despite the slight sort of frisson in the papers this
morning...
You
can say that because you're in a safe Conservative seat.
Yeah, but even if I was... Well, if I was in a seat where there was a Labour MP, I would almost certainly want that Labour MP to be elected. So last year in the general election, I campaigned for Labour MPs or for candidates who I thought would do a good job. You know, it's no...
You know that Jeremy Corbyn is not fit to be Prime Minister.
It's no secret that I would not have chosen Jeremy Corbyn to be the leader of the Labour Party, but I would still rather see a Labour government in place than a Conservative government. Incidentally, given the polls today... It looks as if we may well have reached peak Corbyn, because I don't think we are necessarily in a position where Jeremy Corbyn would win a general election. That's part of my condemnation of him. It's not the whole, but actually I'm not in politics because I want to fanny around in opposition feeling good about myself. I'm in politics because I want to be part of a party that is in government making a change, and I don't think he can do that.
See, I think you think that Theresa May would be a better Prime Minister than Jeremy Corbyn.
You may think that, Ian, you would be wrong.
I think so. I couldn't possibly comment. Do you think the Home Office is too big a government department for one person?
Now, this is interesting because we had a discussion, was it last week or the week before, about whether or not you should take the Immigration Department out. Firstly, the Home Office is not only run by one person. There's one person who gets the flak when things go wrong, but there are, of course, more people than that. Before I became Home Secretary, Don Reid had negotiated the separation of prisons out of the Home Office into the Ministry of Justice. And I thought that made sense because it meant that you had all of those elements that related to the sort of criminal justice system together in one department. And then you had the Home Office, which really became much more like a sort of Homeland Security department with immigration, counter-terror, which had grown considerably, so it took up a much larger amount of time, and crime and policing in the same department. What that meant then was that you do have a very harsh and difficult environment within the Home Office. I think Theresa May rightly described it as, when talking to Ken Clark when he was Secretary of State for Justice, she said, I catch them and lock them up and you let them out. And that is the slight vibe between the Home Office and the Ministry of Justice. But no, I don't. I think tinkering with the machinery of government is not going to solve the enormous mess that the Home Office has got into with immigration. It's a policy problem. It's a problem of setting a crude target for immigration. It's a problem of not focusing on what you need to do in order to make that system work. And God help us when the Home Office has got to deal with the immigration arrangements for European citizens post-Brexit. But separating it out ain't going to solve that problem. Staying in the EU will solve that problem.
We've got 7 minutes left, three more questions to get through, and we've had absolutely no smut in this podcast yet. I think it's because we're actually in the same room.
I did talk about you being bare sometimes when you... Is that not smutty?
No. Right, let's go on. Can you discuss the pros and cons of national identity cards to monitor borders and establish rights of residence? Well, basically, you're in favour of them, I'm not.
Are you not?
No.
Have you not seen the error of your ways?
No, not really. I just don't want to live in a country where you can be asked for your papers at random. It's not British.
Because it's not about asking for your papers. There is an irony, isn't there, that the biggest place that you find lost passports is on the floors of nightclubs as they sweep up in the morning, because young people, in order to have a proof of age, take their passports out with them. That you have people willing to give enormous amounts of their personal information to Facebook, Google and others, and yet they're not, and then they worry about the way in which it's being used. And then you have people, I mean, sometimes wrongly in my view, but you have people complaining about whether or not somebody in this country is entitled to receive a particular service or even entitled to be in the country, and yet no way of demonstrating their entitlement or their right.
You have all complete confidence in the state to maintain the security of that information when under the Labour government, the HMRC basically lost most of our tax information on this because they sent them through the first-class post.
There have been major balls-ups under both governments, actually, with the use of data, but incidentally, enormous balls up in the private sector as well, and somehow or another, people don't seem to mind giving their information there. What the system was, incidentally, was less about ID cards and more about an ID database. In other words, it was a simple way, using biometrics, to enable people to tie their identity to themselves, so that you could then prove your identity much more easily without having to trail off to open up a bank account with three different utility bills and God knows what else that you need. And it would have made it, I mean, I never actually thought it was the way that you would deal with terrorism, but it would have made it much easier for individuals to prove their identity. And the fact that there are now Tories arguing for it in the wake of the Windrush scandal suggests to me that I was right and Theresa May was wrong.
Get you. I've craftily left this one to almost last. John says, what does Ian think is the best way to deal with the Irish border conundrum? Well, in about 90 seconds, look, I think that if the Irish government doesn't want a border, if the EU says it doesn't want a border, the British government says it doesn't want a border, then there ought to be ways of making sure that there isn't a border. There have been all sorts of technological developments, which even the EU itself has published papers on. You look at the way that goods come through the Port of Felixstowe now. Do you ever see a customs officer at the Port of Felixstowe? No, you don't, because it's all done through technology. You look at the Port of Dublin, it's done in exactly the same way.
That's within the single market, the customs union.
In the Port of Felixstowe, there's all sorts of countries coming, sending goods through it, so they don't have this issue there. So what I believe is happening is that Brussels is weaponizing this issue because they see the British government in quite a weak position, and they're using everything they can to delay things, to bring in difficulties where there ought not to be any difficulties, because they think that is the way of delaying Brexit until a new government can come in to stop it happening in the first place.
Good. I incidentally don't think that that's what the EU are doing. What the EU are doing is pointing out that if you choose to exit the EU, there will be consequences of doing that. Yeah, but the trouble with you Brexiteers is that you are sort of sulking and getting angry about...
Do I look as if I'm sulking?
About the fact that there are really, really difficult consequences of choosing to leave the EU.
There are consequences, but there are some difficulties that are being exaggerated for political effect. That's what's happening now.
What, you think Leo Varadkar is doing it for political...
I absolutely do, because Leo Varadkar, back in September last year, made a really good speech in Belfast outlining what he thought could be a viable customs option for Britain with the Ireland and the EU. He was then stepped upon by Brussels to stop talking in this way, and he's basically towing their line now. I mean, he was actually coming up with really good suggestions not that long ago.
There are ways in which you can minimise the impact of a harder border, but there is no way that you can leave the EU, leave the customs union, leave the single market, and still have the same frictionless trade that you had before. And people have just got to face up to that reality. So the answer to that question is the only way that you can avoid that without having to go through extremely lengthy and longer, incidentally, than the current transition period, arrangement arrangements and new electronic methods and new systems of sorting out what's coming in and out through that border in advance. The only way you can avoid that is by not leaving the EU.
And disrespecting the views of 17.4 million voters.
Well, personally, I would like us to get to the point where a deal, if it's possible, is negotiated, and then we say to the British people, you were previously offered a binary decision, in or out. Well, it might just be that things have changed.
Well, we've got 1.5 minutes to go. I'm told by the assembly rooms that if we don't finish on time, there's sort of a cattle prod effect coming up from under the chairs. So the final question, this is not from someone here, it's from someone on Twitter, says, what is your favourite ever novel and why?
Well, given where we are sitting, I am a bit of a fan of Pride and Prejudice, I have to say, although I was a bit shocked to find out that Jane Austen didn't actually like Bath very much.
How could you not
like
Bath?
She was wrong. It's lovely.
My answer would be either Animal Farm or Watership Down. Because Watership Down, I just remember...
Slightly different.
It's the first book that actually made me cry.
And you've been crying ever since.
I have been crying ever since. And Animal Farm, I think everybody who thinks socialism is the answer to everything ought to read Animal Farm. But there we go.
My father, who is a big socialist, made me read Animal Farm when I was younger.
It didn't cure you, though, did it?
It's a particular type of socialism, Ian, of course, okay, that is being condemned in Animal Farm.
If you say so. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure to be here in Bath today doing a live version of the podcast. It's been quite a slightly different dynamic,
yeah,
hasn't it?
It's been lovely.
But I've really enjoyed it. If you would like to listen to us all the time, you can take the lead from Caroline over there, who's listened to every one of the 29 episodes that we've recorded so far. Oh, you missed one. It's still time to catch up. If you would like to subscribe, you can do so via iTunes or any other podcast platform. Do leave a review as well. If you want to listen to me on the radio, I'm on LBC Radio every weekday between 4 and 7. You can get it all over the country now on digital radio and all sorts of other ways as well. So it's goodbye from me.
And goodbye from me.
I didn't even clap.